From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Isn't it amazing? We're so bound by customs and rituals. Somebody just has to press my button. This button marked tradition. And I start responding like a trained monkey. Do I shock you?
Yes.
As President Clinton continues his trip through the Indian subcontinent, we'll talk about the role of women in India. Also, today before the Congress, a $1.6 billion plan for Colombia, a top lieutenant in the U.S. war on drugs, talks about the policy he helped enforce. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Gunmen lined up and fatally shot 40 Sikh villagers in India's disputed northern territory of Kashmir. The killings cast a pall over the start of President Clinton's visit to the country. Monday night shootings were the first major attack on Sikhs in Kashmir. Until now, the minority religious group has been spared from an Islamic rebellion that began a decade ago in Kashmir, a Himalayan region divided between India and Pakistan along an uneasy ceasefire line. Concentrated in a handful of towns and villages, most Kashmiri Sikhs have remained neutral in the conflict, many of them running trucking companies that supply the more remote region, the only Muslim-majority territory in otherwise Hindu-dominated India. Indian Army officers had warned they expected a major operation by pro-separatist militants as a way to focus attention on the Kashmir dispute during Clinton's visit. Thomas Middelhoff, chief executive of Bertelsmann AG, said yesterday the German media giant will join a $10 billion mark or $5 billion compensation fund for Nazi-era slave laborers. The outline of the fund, which aims to compensate survivors of concentration camps and forced work schemes, was agreed late last year, but the German government and survivors groups are still in tense negotiations to decide the details. Middelhoff said there was no evidence to show the firm employed forced labor or slave laborers under Adolf Hitler, and the contribution was not an admission of guilt. Some 65 top German firms, including blue chips like Siemens, Volkswagen, and Daimler Chrysler, launched the fund after legal threats and warnings they may face trade sanctions in the United States. Industry will pay 5 billion marks under the settlement, while Germany must pay the equal sum from the public purse for its contribution. President Bill Clinton has eased sanctions imposed on India after its nuclear tests in 1998 to allow a $25 million U.S. program to strengthen Indian financial markets to resume, according to the White House. The move will allow the financial institution's reform and expansion program, funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development, to resume, providing technical assistance to India's regulatory agencies and financial markets. The sanctions have already been eased once in October to lift restrictions placed on certain environmental programs, and U.S. officials say they may be relaxed further during Clinton's four-day, five-city Indian trip. H. Rapp Brown, the former Black Panther leader, was arrested after a shootout with U.S. Marshals in connection with last week's fatal shooting of a deputy. Now known as Jameel Abdullah Al-Amin, he was arrested last night in Alabama's Lowndes County, west of Montgomery, according to an FBI agent. Authorities spotted him hiding in a shed, they said, 3 days after he allegedly killed one sheriff's deputy and seriously wounded another while they tried to serve him with an arrest warrant in Atlanta, 160 miles northeast of Montgomery, Alabama. The FBI agent said Al-Amin immediately began firing shots at the team of U.S. Marshals who found him in the shed, then ran into nearby woods. Federal and state agents circled him, then released dogs into the area. Again, this according to the FBI. Within moments, Al-Amin was arrested uninjured. Several other people were being detained for possibly, quote, harboring a fugitive, though no charges have been filed, according to the Atlanta police chief. It was not immediately clear what led up to the confrontation in the shed. Community leaders and politicians have stepped up demands for federal oversight of the New York Police Department in the wake of the police shooting of an unarmed African-American man. Yesterday, the Reverend Al Sharpton met with Brooklyn U.S. Attorney Loretta Lynch. Sharpton says he urged Lynch to impose a federal monitor in brutality cases. New York Congressmember Charles Rangel wrote to Attorney General Janet Reno about the same thing. And finally, Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, also of New York, the city's top lawyer, says that he had a right to release Patrick Dorisman's criminal record, including a sealed juvenile offense. Patrick Dorisman being the 26-year-old security guard who was killed by undercover police on Thursday morning. Dorisman fatally shot after he stepped out of a bar, approached by police, and they asked him for drugs. Various activists are accusing Mayor Giuliani of breaking the law by releasing a sealed juvenile record of Dorisman, a record of activities that Dorisman was charged with when he was 13 years old. You're listening to Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
So, what do we have to do today?
Wear fancy saris, heavy jewelry, anything we wish.
Except eat and drink.
You don't have to keep the fast if you don't want.
You must be joking. My mother would kill me, and PG, she'd never stop ringing the bell. Isn't it amazing? We are so bound by customs and rituals. Somebody just has to press my button. This button marked tradition. And I start responding like a trained monkey. Do I shock you?
Yes.
You're lovely.
A scene from the Indian film Fire by Deepa Mehta. It was a bold, taboo-breaking film that ended up being banned in India. Fire is the first film to confront lesbianism in a culture that adamantly denies that such a love can exist. We're joined on the telephone right now by Urvashi Batalia. She is co-founder of India's first feminist publishing company, founded about 16 years ago, publishing third world studies on women. We welcome you to Democracy Now! From New Delhi, India. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Urvashi Batalia. Can you hear us? Well, we'll have to go back and give her a call. India has a population of approximately 900 million people, half of which are women. The Hindu caste system structures Indian society in a complex hierarchy that can be socially oppressive for the majority of women. Not only are the lower castes and tribal groups socially ostracized and oppressed, but women from these groups face multiple oppressions that are aligned along the lines of gender, caste, and class. Historical and traditional caste, gender, class, and religious oppressions were further exacerbated during 300 years of British colonial rule that empowered some higher caste women through access to education and economy, but simultaneously marginalized those at the bottom. Current economic conditions have worsened the divisions among women. One of the people who first who has focused on this issue and also focused on how poverty increases, overall poverty increases women's poverty, is Vandana Shiva. And Vandana Shiva is well known for her activism and also for the book she wrote. In fact, the publishing house Kali, Asia's first feminist publishing company, was the first to publish Vandana Shiva. And each book she writes each year is also published by the Kali Publishing House. We are joined again by Urvashi Batalia from New Delhi, the founder of Kali Publishing House. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks.
It's very good to have you with us from New Delhi. Let me start out by asking, you're in the city where the U.S. President Bill Clinton has recently arrived. What has been the reception for him? I understand, for example, that protests are banned on the streets.
Yes, well, there's a lot of excitement, as is to be expected, at the official level. There have been some attempts at protests, but they haven't really allowed them to come out and protest because of the heavy security. And I think at a general people's level, if you like, there isn't, you know, that much excitement because people are not really that bothered. But there's also quite a lot of irritation at the traffic jams and the rerouting that people have to do on their way to work, as always happens when there's some dignitary or the other visiting.
Mm-hmm. In the news headlines, we just read this story of 40 Sikh villagers being fatally shot last night in India's disputed northern territory of Kashmir. Later in the week, mm-hmm. we'll talk more about the politics of Kashmir. But you have written extensively, historically, about what happened to women at the time of partition, India's independence, also at the time of the division between Pakistan and India. Can you give us a feminist perspective on how your country was divided and what happened to half the population?
Well, yes. You know, the thing is that the history of partition that we tends to learn in school and at university really takes no account of what happened to ordinary human beings. And one of the key histories that has remained hidden is how women were implicated and involved. And there's a history of tremendous violence towards women, of the mass rape and abduction and also impregnation in the way that you saw in Bosnia-Herzegovina recently at the time in 1947. And then both countries, which have, you know, constantly been at loggerheads with each other, getting together very quickly after partition to come to an agreement about finding these women who had been abducted or raped and bringing them back forcibly almost to their, what they defined as their own countries, which they sort of defined in terms of the religion of the woman. So if you were a Hindu woman, but you might have been living in what became Pakistan, you were forced to come back to India. And a lot of women protested about this. A lot of them were then, when they came back or when they were found and brought back to what was seen as their own country, you know, they were not accepted by their families, particularly in India, because there's a strong taboo in the Hindu religion against what is seen as pollution by means of having sex with a man of the other religion. So, in a sense, the history of the mass rape of women is very much a part of the history of partition, and we don't actually hear much about it.
How have your writings... Did you ever finish the book that you were writing on that period 50 years ago? And how were your writings received in India?
Well, I was actually amazed at the amount of interest, and you know, because it's very difficult to talk to people about that time of pain and grief, but actually the reaction was very wonderful, with people of all ages commenting on how glad they were to see the history written down, because they felt in some way that the experiences that they have been holding inside families have been recognized and legitimized. And those experiences form so much, you know, a kind of bedrock of the reality of extreme polarization on questions of religion that we are living in India today. And I think we need to really understand them. And there was a sense that work like mine is not the only book. It was one of the books that have started to come out around this time. That this is helping in some way to open up those debates.
Urvashi Batalia, we began this segment by playing an excerpt of the film Fire that lit India on fire, at least a small sector of it, when it was released in the last few years. Can you explain why the movie was so controversial in India, why it was banned?
Yes, well, no, the movie was never banned in India. Fire was, you know, that's a misconception. Fire ran to packed houses in India. What actually happened was that a small group of right-wing fundamentalists who see themselves as self-appointed guardians of public morality attacked the cinema theater in Delhi where the show was on and tried to create a problem and insisted that the film be taken off the screens, but in fact it wasn't. It continued to run. There was huge debate about it in the newspapers, on television, and so on. And it ran its life, and then it stopped. And it was replaced by other films. But I think the more important issue is that what we are seeing in India now is a very unfortunate kind of street censorship by people who take it upon themselves to act as, you know, guardians of public morality and who are obviously extremely conservative and very anti-woman. And therefore, the next film that this same director, Deepa Mehta, was making was the one that actually faced quite a lot of attack and the shooting has been stopped as a result of this.
It's interesting. Fire, as advertised in this country, I guess the way they sell it is by saying banned in India. But can you explain that it also fits into the politics of modern day India? Who is in power today and who the right wing Hindu group is that fought so hard against it to try to get it banned in India?
You see, the party that is in power is the Bharatiya Janata Party, or the BJP for short, which is a right-wing party that is made up of a number of smaller parties who are, you know, they call themselves the family of parties, rather like the mafia. And they have many different arms. And some of them speak with extremely moderate but still fairly conservative voices, and the others are the more violent element. So the people who actually attacked Deepa Mehta's second film was a group which is run by one of the small arms of this party, and that arm is called the Vishwa Hindu Parishad. And that group called itself the cultural arm, or a cultural group out to protect the cultural identity of India, by which they mean Hindu India. They don't mean the diverse, plural country that this country is. You know. So there are many such arms of that particular political party which do different things and speak with different voices, but it all adds up to a very, very conservative, very reactionary agenda where censorship is, you know, becoming a very real fear for both writers and filmmakers and many other people.
I know in the case of Deepa Mehta, we were talking about Fire, but she's also made Earth, the film Earth, which talks about the Muslim-Hindu divisions in India, and then Water, which has been stopped in the making. Is that right?
That's right, yes.
Why?
Yes, Earth did reasonably well. I mean, I don't think it was a big commercial success, but there was no problem with the film and what it was trying to show, because really partition histories are beginning to open up now. Mm-hmm. Water was stopped because there was all this stuff that they feared that it was presenting a bad image of India abroad, and because it talked about the treatment of widows, and the people who tried to stop it claimed that, in fact, we don't treat widows so badly. But that's nonsense. You know, the position of widows in this country is very bad, and there's no point beginning to hide that.
The position of widows being?
Being, well, in Hindu religion, Quite often what happens is the widow is considered inauspicious because now the man is dead, and often, you know, there's been a lot of attempt to reform this from the 19th century on, with changes in the law and so on. But there are still places like Banaras, otherwise known as Varanasi, where the film was being shot, and another place called Vrindavan, where widows are sent by their families to live out their own life in a great deal of poverty, deprivation. The excuse is that they're going there to communicate with God and they will find salvation, but actually what happens to them, many of them, is that they are extremely poor, very oppressed, and some, the younger ones, are often either forced into or go into prostitution as a way of earning money to keep body and soul together.
Urvashi Batalia, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back and wrap up the discussion, I wanted to ask you about an issue that's very hot in the United States, and that's the issue of abortion and women's reproductive rights and where India stands on it. Urvashi Batalia is co-founder of India's first feminist publishing company. It's called Kali for Women, founded in 1984, publishes women's fiction, creative, academic books, has published more than 100 books over the last decade and a half. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman.
With Sita.
Good. She looks happy these days. Maybe she's pregnant. You didn't hear me calling?
Yes, I did.
Why didn't you come?
Sita says the concept of duties overrated.
She's young, but you know its importance. Radha?
A scene from the film Fire, that is by Deepa Mehta, the Indian film. As she talks about the concept of duty being overrated. Our guest on the phone right now, Urvashi Batalia, co-founder of India's first feminist publishing company, Asia's first feminist publishing company. It's called Kali for Women, and she is in New Delhi. The issue of abortion. Is abortion legal in India?
Yes, abortion has been legal since 1972, but more as a way of family planning rather than as a question of choice.
What about the more conservative forces or religious forces in India? It's never been an issue?
No, it's never been an issue in that sense, because I think that despite the fact of its being legal, it's not, you know, not that many women go in for it because they still need to get their families or their husbands or whoever it is to, in a sense, to agree, not necessarily legally, but in terms of, you know, family relationships and so on. So it hasn't really been an issue, even though it isn't, for example, allowed in Islam or in Catholicism. But theoretically, it exists for anybody who wishes to use it.
The issue of sonograms is one that is more controversial. Can you explain that?
Yes, that is much more controversial in the sense that, you know, once that technology became available, it was very rapidly misused to find out the sex of the, the child and often to abort female fetuses. And there was a very, very big campaign carried out by women's groups starting in Bombay and then moving all over the country to get these tests banned except for medical purposes. And the backlash, or there was a counter-argument that came up from a number of, you know, fairly progressive intellectuals, which said that if you can demand that the woman has a choice in whether or not to have the child, then it is only an extension of that choice, that she chooses the sex of the child. And why are you saying that that choice is not legitimate and the first one is? And it was a very difficult sort of argument to deal with, especially because it was coming from the sort of people that women's groups would have expected to ally with them.
Urvashi Batalia, we have to wrap up, co-founder of India's first feminist publishing company in New Delhi. Do you have a website or way people can get in touch?
Yes, we do. It's just called KaliBooks.com, and I'd love for people to visit it.
Again, more than 100 books published by the feminist publishing house Kali for Women, of which Urvashi Batalia is a co-founder. And we thank you very much for being with us from New Delhi. As we continue,
thank you.
As we continue our series on the situation in India, in the next few days, we'll be looking at, among other issues, Union Carbide, one of the worst industrial disasters of the century. Not only have protests been banned in Delhi, in New Delhi, but all over the country, there were thousands of activists planning to march from Bhopal to where President Clinton was going to be. He has canceled his trip to the area, but they too have been banned. There's now discussion of whether they will engage in civil disobedience. Before we turn to another major issue of the day, the issue of Colombia and a vote that's expected today on a $1.6 billion aid package to the South American country that would make it the third largest recipient of U.S. aid after Israel and Egypt. We're going to turn now to a story that we've just gotten off the news wire. A federal judge in Miami today dismissed the lawsuit aimed at keeping 6-year-old Elian Gonzalez in the United States, saying only the U.S. Attorney General can grant asylum to the Cuban boy. U.S. District Judge Michael Moore's ruling comes 12 days after hearing arguments in the lawsuit filed by Elian's great-uncle, Lazaro Gonzalez. Gonzalez wants to keep Elian against the wishes of the boy's father in Cuba. The U.S. government had asked the judge to dismiss the lawsuit, which asked the court to compel the Immigration and Naturalization Service to give Elian an asylum hearing. We turn right now to attorney Michael Ratner with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who's been quite involved with the case. What is your reaction to this ruling, and what does it mean, Michael?
Well, I think it's a very significant and important ruling. I mean, it's actually a major break in the case, I hope. What it means is that the district court said that the attorney general is the proper person to speak for the boy. She has said the boy's father in Cuba is his guardian and should speak for him on immigration matters. The court upheld that decision of the attorney general and said there's no authority of the federal court to override such a decision. So it is a very, very significant ruling. The question is, what happens next? First, there can be an appeal, obviously, although there's no stay of sending the boy back to Cuba. So if the attorney general had any courage, or this administration did, they would send the kid back to Cuba almost immediately rather than wait for an appeal. The appeal could take as short as a few weeks. It could take a few months. Every month that kid stays here, I think, is very, very bad for the child's psyche. So it is a significant ruling. It was legally pretty much of a slam dunk. There is no jurisdiction in federal courts to override the Attorney General's decision on this. But politically, it wasn't such a slam dunk, and it was a Miami federal judge. And so the guy obviously showed some courage in the face of a Miami community. That obviously wanted a different, that many of whom wanted a different decision. So it is a very, very important decision. The other worry, obviously, in this case is that Congress could get back in the act and try and make this kid a citizen again. Hopefully that will not occur, that there's enough understanding, and even among conservative members of Congress, that that's not proper, even from a family value point of view, you know, which they've always said was important to them. So hopefully we're beginning to see the end of the case. You know, but I've thought that before, and it is a real problem that our political leaders haven't had the courage to just send this kid back. There is nothing, there's no court order or anything. stopping them from doing so, only the politics of a small Miami right-wing Cuban community.
So it's now in Attorney General Janet Reno's court.
Well, that's correct. She, Attorney General Reno, can now decide tomorrow, today, to send that child back to Cuba. She can do it. They'll say, well, we're going to appeal, but they can appeal all they want. But she has a right to send that child back, unless the upper court prohibits her from doing so, or unless, like she did in this case, she says, I will let the proceedings go ahead until there's a final order. And, of course, that's what she said once, and she's probably going to say it again, feeling that she'd rather have the court on the hook rather than the political administration in an election year.
So whose court does it go to?
Well, it goes to the Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, which is in Atlanta. It's an appeal to three judges would decide it, both on the question of whether there's a stay of the kid being sent back, of Elian being sent back to Cuba, and whether or not there's a right for the great uncle to file an asylum petition on his behalf.
So there would be probably less protest in Atlanta, considering the courts have until now been in Miami.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, what I think the Clinton administration was banking on is that a court order saying this kid should go back to Cuba, that Elian should go back, is going to be easier to enforce and might be obeyed by the Miami Cuban community more than an order from the Attorney General. And they didn't want to see the Attorney General sending marshals in to get the child out. I think she was wrong about that, but she's probably right about the fact that if there's a court order, that the chances are more likely that she won't have to send in federal marshals.
So this puts Gore in a difficult position. Gore, who receives money from the right-wing Miami Cuban community, who hasn't he said that he felt that Elian should stay?
He basically said he disagreed with Janet Reno that the kid should go back to Cuba. Disagreed about the father being free to make that decision. Hillary Clinton didn't do any better. She said something to the effect of the mother's wishes, the mother who took him here and died on the way, should be considered in any decision. So I think our politicians have all, the Democrats as well as the Republicans, have basically bent to the major funding they received from that community. I think Gord received over $300,000 from the Miami Cubans. So you're not seeing exactly, honest, straight politicians on this deal.
Michael Ratner, I want to thank you for being with us for this late-breaking news. Again, a judge in Miami has just dismissed the lawsuit aimed at keeping 6-year-old Elian Gonzalez in the United States, saying only the U.S. Attorney General can grant asylum to the Cuban boy. Among other websites, you can go to Michael Ratner's, who's affiliated with the Center for Constitutional Rights, at humanrightsnow.com. That's humanrightsnow.com. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we look at how local and national issues connect to international issues, today we're going to talk about the U.S. war on drugs. In New York, as you know, over the last week, there has been serious protest over the killing of an unarmed black man. Patrick Dorisman, a 26-year-old security guard, shot by an undercover police officer on last Thursday morning, after leaving a Manhattan bar. He was approached by the police officer, who asked him if he knew where he could buy drugs, when Patrick said, got angry, saying he shouldn't be asking him this. Ultimately, he was shot. The officer had asked about where he could buy marijuana. This was supposedly part of a police drug sting. Patrick Dorisman, the fourth black man killed by the New York Police Department in the last 13 months. This recent shooting puts the spotlight on a federal anti-drug campaign in New York called Operation Condor. It's part of a larger trend around the nation in the so-called war on drugs, which typically targets low-level drug sales involving marijuana or other drugs. In the push to make more arrests, police strategy has shifted from the observation of actual crime to tactics that can induce crime. In the name of fighting drugs, innocent people of color are commonly targeted. At the center of the debate over the war on drugs is President Clinton's proposal to give $1.6 billion in aid to Colombia, which is up before the Congress today. Critics of the aid package say the war on drugs is a failure and doesn't look at the fundamental issue of demand for drugs here at home. We're joined by a number of people to discuss this issue at various different levels. We're going to start with Sylvester Salcido, who is a retired Navy lieutenant commander who served as an intelligence officer with the Joint Task Force 6, a Department of Defense unit that provides military specialists to law enforcement agencies around the country. He believes the Clinton administration's $1.6 billion aid proposal to Colombia is good money thrown after bad, and we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much, Amy. It's good to be here.
So can you talk about what Operation Condor in New York, which is similar to other campaigns around the country, actually accomplishes and what you had to do with it?
Well, with regards to Operation Condor specifically, I have to say that I really don't know much about the details of it except for what I read in the newspapers, because I retired from the Navy in April of 99. And actually during my service with JTF-6, which was from about November 96 to April 99, I was not directly involved with local operations per se. I was more involved in terms of the strict mission statement of JTF-6, which is to provide training support to various federal law enforcement agencies who are in turn involved with the war on drugs.
So what were you doing exactly?
Well, what I did exactly is difficult to share, because unfortunately I had to sign a non-disclosure agreement when I signed on with JTF-6 as far as the details of day-to-day activities that I perform. However, what I thought would be helpful for your audience is for me to give the sort of big picture look in that in anything that I may have done during my tours with JTF-6, I came away with a conclusion combined with my own personal life experiences in prior activities as a public school teacher in Boston and a citizen in many of our communities, is that this strategy of approaching the so-called war on drugs with interdiction, crop eradication, really is not successful, because what we're doing is really just expending a lot of effort, spending a lot of money that ultimately has no achievable goal that I can see. On the one hand, you're mixing up political goals with military missions, and the military, they can only carry out their orders as given by the national leadership. So in this particular case, my experience is that JTF-6 is given a particular set of marching orders, and they carry that out quite well. Again, just as a way to expand on this issue of JTF-6, in the past 6 weeks since basically my story has been made public by Michael Massing's article in the Sunday Washington Post of February 6, a lot of people have come back to me and said, "Well, Sylvester, exactly what is this with JTF-6? And people sort of have this nefarious image of what JTF-6 is, but really JTF-6 is not some secret component of the military running around amok in our communities. JTF-6 is quite an open publicly to be able to explain, and I certainly will defer to their own public relations officials to explain what is it that they do exactly. However, again, I go back to the confusion really here between what the national leaders, political leaders want, and what it is that a military unit such as JTF-6 can carry out. And that, to me, is one of the major confusing and conflicting issues at hand here. We're mixing what the political leaders want, and they're sort of depending on the military to carry it out, but it's confused.
So the military is training law enforcement agencies around the country. And that's what the JTF-6 program actually does, right? It's working with agents from the DEA, FBI, Customs, and local police departments to penetrate drug gangs, disrupt money
laundering. No, what's happening there is actually it's the military personnel themselves who are participating, who are receiving or enhancing their own training. it's I know it's kind of confused here, but most at least the people I've worked with are mostly from the intelligence field within the military, the different branches: Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps. And all they're doing really is being of assistance because of the Posse Comitatus Act. And for those of the members of your audience who are not familiar with that, that's the law that prohibits the military from carrying out direct law enforcement activities within the borders of the United States of America, because otherwise then we would be under martial law.
We're talking to Sylvester Salcido, retired Navy Lieutenant Commander, served as intelligence officer with Joint Task Force 6, a Department of Defense unit providing military specialists to law enforcement agencies. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As he talks about what so angered him about the Clinton administration's $1.6 billion aid proposal to Colombia, making him want to return his Navy medal. When we come back, we'll also speak with Colombian union activists. We'll talk about what that money means when sent to Colombia, usually to shore up the Colombian military. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk to Sylvester Salcido, retired Navy Lieutenant Commander, served as intelligence officer with Joint Task Force 6, a Department of Defense unit that provides military specialists to law enforcement agencies around the country. When the U.S. put forward, the Clinton administration put forward the $1.6 billion aid package to Colombia, supposedly to fight the war on drugs, Sylvester Salcido returned his Navy medal, and you returned it with a letter to President Clinton. Can you read that letter?
Yes. Dear President Clinton, I am returning the enclosed Navy and Marine Corps Achievement Medal to you in protest of your administration's current national drug policy. Specifically, I would urge you to cancel your emergency spending proposal of $1.3 billion over the next 2 years to expand the American military involvement in Colombia for counter-drug operations. In my opinion, narcotics use and abuse is our problem here at home. The solutions should be applied here and not in Colombia or elsewhere. To spend this amount of money overseas is wasteful and counterproductive. Instead, I urge you to review and consider the drug policy under the Nixon administration that emphasized treatment on demand and prevention, not interdiction, arrest, and incarceration, to address this national public health issue and its consequences as encountered by individuals, families, and communities across our great country. It was a policy that worked. It was a policy that brought down crime rates without mass arrest and long prison terms. It was a policy that did not send more and more men and women, especially from our minority communities, to jail. It was a policy that is worth a second look today. I implore you to call for an end to the war on drugs as we know it today. I implore you to call for peace and treatment for those in need of help to overcome substance abuse. I implore you to call for peace, compassion, and amnesty for those jailed by draconian drug laws to reunite families and rebuild communities. Most of all, I implore you to call for peace and an immediate nationwide review and dialogue at the national to neighborhood level about the destructiveness and senselessness of the current American federal narcotics prohibition policies and practices. Very respectfully, Sylvester Salcido.
And what was the response of the Clinton administration?
Well, actually, Amy, I'm still waiting for an informal or formal response from the president or any of his representatives.
It's quite rare for someone to return their Navy medal.
Well, actually, I was really thinking somewhere along the lines that I'm just really following in the footsteps of people like the Vietnam veterans who were against the Vietnam War, people such as, Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, where I used to live, and many others like them, who really, as a matter of exercising their own free speech rights, tried to make their small voices heard in across the country.
Well, as you return your Navy medal, Sylvester Salcido, retired Navy Lieutenant Commander, who was an intelligence officer with Joint Task Force 6, I want to look at what this war on drugs means around this country and also what means on the ground in Colombia. Starting in this country, Deborah Small is with us, attorney and director of the Public Policy and Community Outreach for Linda Smith Center, a leading drug policy research and advocacy project. What does it mean here at home in terms of numbers of people incarcerated and who gets picked up? I learned an interesting fact yesterday. I didn't realize that more than half of drug arrests are low-level marijuana arrests.
Yes, I think that that's information that's been kept from the American public in general as the politicians and others have continued to ratchet up the offensive on the war on drugs. Most people believe that the majority of law enforcement is really focusing on higher-level dealers and people who are actually responsible for the large amount of drugs in the community. But in fact, you know, one in two of all of the national arrests for drugs are for marijuana offenses. And so out of 1.5 million last year, about 750,000 of those had to do with marijuana, either possession or sale of small amounts of marijuana. In New York City, what's so amazing to me about Operation Condor and the fact that they're actually arresting tens and thousands of people for marijuana in New York City is that marijuana is decriminalized in New York. I mean, you are legally able to possess up to 25 grams of marijuana in your house, and the most that you could be charged with is a violation and pay a $100 fine. So the fact that we have law enforcement officials putting in almost $24 million worth of overtime to go after, you know, bust a $5 worth of marijuana or to bust people who were smoking a joint in public is just absurd to me. But it results in the situation that we have in the state where out of our prison population has grown dramatically in the last two decades from about 12,000 to 70,000. And out of the 70,000 people who are incarcerated in New York, 20,000 of them are drug
offenders. What about nationally?
Nationally, there's 2 million people behind bars in New York, in the nation, in state and federal prison. And out of those 2 million, about two-thirds of them are there for nonviolent drug offenses.
And people of color, what proportion?
Well, you know, that is just an issue that's hard for me to even talk about, because when you travel around the country and look and see who are in our jails, they're primarily poor people and overwhelmingly people of color. More than two-thirds of the people who are incarcerated for drug offenses alone are either black or Latino. And the number of women who've gone to jail for drug offenses has gone up 800% in the last 10 years. And yet, every study that the government has ever done on drug use shows that it exists equally across every spectrum and within every racial group and every nationality in the United States. So it seems to me that if this was the war on drugs was really about drugs, that we would be enforcing the law just as strongly in suburban communities as we're enforcing it in inner city communities. But that's not what's happening. Suburban kids are not going to jail for using cocaine, for having a couple of bags of heroin, and they're certainly not getting shot for that.
Deborah Smalls with the Linda Smith Center, a drug policy research and advocacy project of George Soros' Open Society Institute. That's looking at what's happening in this country. Now let's look at the other end. As Congress weighs today whether to pass this $1.6 billion aid package to Colombia, making it the third largest recipient of U.S. Money after Israel and Egypt, Let's look at what it means on the ground in Colombia. On the phone with us is Patricia Buritisa Cespedes, director of the Department of Women and member of the National Executive Committee of Colombia's largest union federation, the Central Organization of Workers in Colombia. She's in the United States traveling from state to state to talk about what this policy means. She's translated by Winifred Tate of the Washington Office on Latin America. Welcome to Democracy Now, Patricia.
Muchas gracias. Many thanks.
Can you tell us what the aid package will mean for Colombia?
Para nosotros como sindicalistas,
for those of us in Colombia who are union activists,
en lo que han dicho ustedes hasta
we agree what everyone has said so
la estrategia militar en Colombia
the military strategy in Colombia has never helped us find peace in our country. It's even made the conflict worse.
I'm just going to interrupt for 1 minute just to say it's a little hard to hear you, Winifred, translating right over the Spanish. Thanks.
En Colombia, la mayoría de violación de derechos humanos se realiza contra sindicalistas.
In Colombia, one of the hardest hit sectors by in terms of human rights violations are union activists.
El 78% de violaciones de derechos humanos se han hecho en el desarrollo de conflictos laborales. Entonces, cuando pensamos en que la ayuda militar que se está planteando, casi el 70% es destinado a comprar aviones, a comprar armas, creemos que esto no va a contribuir a una solución de paz, sino a una solución de guerra.
About 78% of human rights violations we have traced in some way impacting workers or workers' rights. So when we see this aid package is almost 80% made up of simply military hardware, military training, we're very concerned about the impact it's going to have in the war in Colombia.
Eso significa que la mayoría de las acciones que hoy se realizan en Colombia contra el narcotráfico están ligadas al conflicto armado, al conflicto social y al conflicto político, y que la solución no puede ser militar, sino tiene que ser de carácter político, como se ha planteado en Colombia, que es una solución política a la situación de crisis en todos los sentidos, tanto desde el narcotráfico hasta los conflictos sociales y políticos.
What we've seen in Colombia is that all the social problems are being treated with military solutions, and that includes the issue of drug production and drug trafficking, as well as the social problems. What we really need in Colombia is assistance in building peace in our country that will help us deal with drug trafficking and will address the roots of the social conflict rather than military assistance that will escalate the war.
La mayoría de está destinada en ese momento para la erradicación de cultivos vía fumigación, y lo que se ha demostrado en los últimos 10 años es que la política ha sido absolutamente ineficiente y que hoy tenemos más cultivos y más propagandización de la droga en Colombia, lo que significa que podemos coincidir con algunos de los elementos fundamentales que ha planteado el señor Silvestre Salcedo.
We agree completely with some of the comments made by Silvestre Salcedo. When you look at the incredible resources that have been spent on fumigation campaigns and aerial eradication campaigns focusing on coca production in Colombia that have been completely ineffective, what we've seen, despite all this money and all this effort, that coca production in Colombia has actually increased and there's more people involved in drug production now than there ever was before.
Quisiera hacer un énfasis en que esta ayuda que se le está planteando a Colombia habría una necesidad absolutamente clara de que nosotros exigiéramos a los contribuyentes estadounidenses que sería una contribución para la guerra nuestra y no para la paz.
What we really want to communicate to people in the United States who are, as taxpayers, going to be really funding this program, that that they be aware that this is going to be a program that's going to be for war in Colombia, not for peace.
Con la compra de aviones y armas se podría solucionar, con el dinero equivalente a esa compra, se podría solucionar casi que parte de la crisis de los hospitales públicos o de la educación pública en nuestro país.
With the money that is going to be spent on helicopters and weapons, you could solve the crisis that's facing public hospitals, public education in our country.
Y creemos también que el problema del narcotráfico es un problema que tiene que ver mucho con el consumo, con la persuasión y con las campañas de que debería adelantar Estados Unidos en contra del consumo mismo y más que el tráfico propiamente dicho.
We think that addressing the impact of drug trafficking, the U.S. would be better spend their money dealing with treatment in the United States, with reducing demand in the United States, rather than focusing on drug production and trafficking in our country.
The AFL-CIO is who has brought you, Patricia Boritisa Cespedes, with the Colombia's largest union federation, and particularly focusing on the plight of women in Colombia. They, interestingly enough, have put out a very strong statement against the Colombia aid package. Can you tell us what the AFL's position is? You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Nosotros estamos acá porque encontramos que la FLCO ha sido una organización absolutamente solidaria con el pensamiento nuestro.
We are here because the AFL-CIO has been very much in solidarity with our thinking.
Ellos han expresado en su declaración su rechazo a la aprobación de la ayuda norteamericana para Colombia porque comparten con nosotros que es una ayuda que va destinada a más conflicto armado y menos solución al conflicto social.
Because they, and in their statement they say what we have been saying, which is that they reject this package because it's going to be increasing the war rather than supporting efforts for negotiated settlement of the conflict.
La ayuda fuera de eso tiene algunos condicionamientos de carácter institucional en el cual el gobierno se compromete a hacer algunas reformas laborales y sociales que irían en detrimento de los derechos de los trabajadores.
We're also concerned that this so-called aid package goes along with a lot of institutional reforms that the Colombian government's trying to make, which are really eroding workers' rights.
Y en ese sentido, la FLCO ha sido absolutamente clara con el gobierno norteamericano en el sentido de que no estaría de acuerdo en que lo que signifique ayuda para el pueblo colombiano signifique es detrimento de derechos y probablemente mayor violación de los derechos sindicales y laborales contra los sindicalistas colombianos.
So the AFL-CIO has been very clear in their conversations with the U.S. government, saying that they see this package as very detrimental to Colombia and will most likely lead to an increase in human rights and worker rights violations.
Not to say that this $1.6 billion is a corporate welfare package for arms manufacturers, but Sylvester Salcedo, where does this $1.6 billion, where does it go?
I believe from some of the breakout lists that I've seen, most of it, I believe 80 to 85% of it, will go to the purchase, maintenance, and operations of about 30 Black Hawk helicopters and 33 Huey helicopters.
That will be sent to Colombia for use by the Colombian military.
Right.
Last comments, Deborah Small of the Linda Smith Center.
Well, I just want people to think about the fact that drug prohibition has not worked any more than alcohol prohibition did. And it's costing tremendous amount of money, and it's costing a tremendous cost in human lives. In the U.S. and abroad, increasingly, drug prohibition is being waged against communities of color. And I think the long-term consequences of that are really beginning to be felt, both in the level of dysfunction that we find in communities because of the high incarceration rates, as well as the erosion of civil liberties that threaten the democracy of all societies.
Deborah Small, website for the Linda Smith Center?
www.lindesmith.org. There's a wealth of information there about drug policy.
And Sylvester Salcedo.
If people want to contact me, they can send me an email. My first initial, last name, and 98, it's SSALCEDO 98@AOL.com. And in closing, I just wanted to say, estoy de acuerdo con todo lo que Patricia dijo. I agree very much with everything that Patricia and the AFL-CIO, and as well as Deborah, said about the fact that we do need peace in our own country regarding this war on drugs.
And I also want to give out the phone number of Congress, because your voice can be heard today. Congress is considering the $1.6 billion package to Colombia. The number, switchboard, 202 202-225-3121, 202-225-3121, and the AFL's website, aflcio.org. That does it for today's show, Democracy Now!, produced by David Love, Maria Carrion, Sputnik Colombi, and Karen Palmer. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Thanks to Robert Knight. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.